Lucas,
well,
come now.
This is the first time I've chaired a meeting this big. I'll tell you what I'd like to do. Everybody here with one day of sobriety, which is everybody in this room, would you please stand up? All right. One day at a time. There you go. I have a tough time remembering that quite often. But, there may be some here who are not familiar with our tradition of personal anonymity at the public level. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and films. Thus, we respectfully ask that no AA speaker or indeed any AA member be identified by full name or photograph and published or broadcast with reports of our meetings. The assurance of anonymity is essential to our effort to help other problem drinkers who may wish to share our recovery program with us. And our tradition of anonymity reminds us that AA principles come before personalities. My name is Peter Fuge, and I'm an alcoholic. This is the banquet evening speakers meeting of the annual Hilton Head Midwinter Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'll open the meeting up in the usual manner with a moment of silent meditation followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not aligned with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I've asked Coney to please read how it works.
Thanks, Peter. My name is Coney. I am an alcoholic. And this is how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. As some of these we bought, we thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We ask his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerful of alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made the decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a certain fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaim, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is, we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter 2 of the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could ever leave our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he was so. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you very much, Tony. From our distaff side, we have Eve H. that's going to read the 12th edition.
My name is Eve, and I am an alcoholic. The 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. See if I forgot anything, you know? I haven't. They've got a checklist for me, so I don't. Well, thanks to you, I made a new friend. And Friday night, I got to meet our speaker. We had dinner together, and we have a lot of similarities. He's Irish, I'm Irish, and, you know, it just goes on and on and on. And I talked to him, and I said, "Ray, you've spoken at a lot of these banquets, and what sort of introduction would you like?" He looked at me and said, "I want it short, because remember now, you're going to be down there for an hour, and I'm going to be up here for an hour. And if you go into some long, drawn-out introduction, then I'm going to get you." So, without further ado, Mr. Ray O'Keefe from the Miami Men's Club.
My name's Ray O'Keefe. I'm an alcoholic and a member of the Miami Men's Group. Good to be with you. I've been an Alcoholics Anonymous a long time. You can tell by looking at me, I've been somewhere for a long time. And I'm happy to be in this room. There's a lot of people here that I've met before. Some of my friends are here from New York and from Connecticut and places around. And my friend Michael and Bob are here from London, England, where I sold them a few years ago my Spiritual Awakening franchise, and they've been doing well with that. And I have the pleasure of listening again to Martha and Rob, and Sue is here, all the Al-Anon ladies. I didn't know there'd be so many Al-Anon women at this meeting because I thought they'd all be over in Buford, where this weekend they're having a very, very important meeting of the Al-Anon family groups. It's being held in the mother church of all Al-Anon, the Church of Our Lady of Perpetual Revenge. Let me tell you about my drinking. I don't want you to miss any of this. This is a thrill a minute. I grew up in one of the neighborhoods in New York City. And my neighborhood was rough, and it was tough, and it was Irish. Now, you may not understand it here in Hilton Head Island, but they drank in that neighborhood. You would actually see people on the street under the influence of alcohol. Difficult thing to believe, but true nevertheless. And if you looked at where I lived, you'd see a little drinking. My mother, the widow O'Keefe, was known to take a drink from time to time. And when the pressure got on, Kitty would go for the light wines and the spirits, and something would fly, usually one of the children. My brother Billy, on the other hand, was a very bad drinker, and in a neighborhood of Irish drunks, Billy O'Keefe stood out. So when I showed up at the local place and ordered up whatever it was they were serving 14-year-olds that afternoon, no one paid any attention to me. It was just another O'Keefe coming through the system. I don't really recall what they gave me that day. I suspect it was a beer. But whatever it was, I liked it. I liked everything about it. I liked the way it looked. And I liked the way it smelled. And I liked the way it tasted. And I liked what it did for my head. And I liked the noise and the smoke and the confusion. And I liked the Irish music and the fist fights. I liked the bullshit. That's what I really liked. And I spent the next 20 years pursuing it. I was going through the parochial school system, in a manner of speaking, and I got into all the difficulties you might imagine a young man would get into trying to go through that system drunk. I was thrown out of high school a number of times. I held the neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record previously established by my brother Billy. When I was finished with high school, or more properly, when they were finished with me, because someone made a mistake, I always thought, I ended up in a small college up in New England and was a long way from the Bronx, and things were different up there. There were no bars in that state, just restaurants, and these people sat around the tables and they drank beer out of bottles and they sang college songs. And they wore white shoes in the wintertime. And being a man of no particular moral fiber, I got a pair of white shoes. I learned the words to some of those songs. I got very collegiate. World War II was just about over, and it was relatively safe. Things were a little slow anyhow. So one day I got a haircut and joined the Navy. And I ended up on a minesweeper out in San Francisco Harbor, and I hate to be indelicate at such a nice gathering, but I have to tell you, I had a lot of trouble with my kidneys when I drank. And in the Navy, we slept three to a tier, and a new man slept on top. Don't get ahead of me, pal. This is very difficult. I came back from my first liberty in San Francisco with all the beer in me I could buy, and I went to sleep and I had one of these attacks. And I met the fellow who slept below me that night. I suppose he thought he'd be wet sometime in his naval career. It just hadn't occurred to him that it would happen while he was sleeping. I was immediately transferred to a lower bunk. The rest of my naval career was undistinguished, and I came back home some years later, undecorated, unhonored, and unloved. And everything was under control in the neighborhood. The widow was out in the weeds somewhere. My brother Billy was absent without leave from the New York City Police Department, having invited a citizen off a five-story roof. The citizen bounced and lived to identify the Irish cop. My brother Billy went west and went to a more peaceful line of work. He went back in the Marine Corps. The government was giving veterans $20 a week for 52 weeks. I qualified for a few checks. I gravitated to the local joint. I took up the game of shuffleboard. And I was planning a life of petty crime with some of my boyhood companions when I had one of those clear thoughts that float through from time to time. I remembered that I'd been to college. So I got on a bus and I went up there. And I got off the bus in the middle of a blizzard and I walked into this place and there they were, sitting around the table, drinking beer out of a bottle, singing those songs, wearing those shoes. So I got another pair of shoes, and now a grateful government was sending me a check every month. So I was relatively solvent and therefore moderately drunk all the time. One day I was staying around the campus in my usual condition, and I noticed a list of names on the bulletin board of people who were qualified to graduate, and my name was on the list. And that was excellent news. I thought I had another year to go. I sent for the widow to come witness this great event, and the widow came north, and that was a very tender sight. The widow and her youngest child staggering around under the elms. Some years later, I served as a trustee of that school. I go to meetings, and they were still talking about my mother. It's not so often in the state of Vermont they see a little old lady get off a train drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning. When I got back to the neighborhood, everything was just quiet there. My uncles, who ran the family, had voted unanimously that I become a New York City policeman, and I told them I didn't want to do that. I had my own plans, and I had received a scholarship to law school, and I told them I'd be unemployed for the next several years, and that was received with mixed emotions. So I took off for law school, and that was a surprise. I didn't know anything about lawyers or law school. We did not have any lawyers in my neighborhood. We had cops and we had priests. We really didn't need any lawyers. I hate to be disloyal to the profession that's made Pete here a wealthy man. But I have to tell you, when I got to law school, I found I was in the company of the greatest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled under one roof. These guys were deadly, and they all had on a blue suit, and they wore eyeglasses. So, once I got into uniform, I looked around and for someone to drink with, but no one was drinking in that crowd. They're all studying. They're all grinding it away. So I went on the wagon for law school. I didn't drink. And I became the biggest grind they ever had in that place. And the result of all of that was when I came out of school, I had done well, and I was taken into a large, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, Wall Street law firm. They sort of hired me as the resident immigrant. It was not a total loss, however. I did learn to say, "Oh, really," instead of "No shit." I'm just beginning to appreciate how bad you are. My superiors there determined that I should be trained as a trial lawyer, and so I was sent up to the courthouse in New York City to learn my trade. And I wasn't in the courthouse very long when I discovered that all the really smart people were in a saloon across the street. So I moved my office into the saloon, and I learned to drink in a more civilized, more genteel fashion. Very few members of the profession were knocking down shots and beers, or anybody could see them. So I discovered scotch in a tall glass with water and ice, and you sip on that. It takes a little while, but it gets the job done. I was introduced to all of the mysteries and all of the rituals that surround the very, very dry martini. And to this evening and to this minute, my love, my admiration, and my affection for the very, very dry martini is surely the greatest case of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal to those things, and they almost destroyed me. Well, after about a year of this civilizing influence, it was necessary in my natural development to be married, and I had located this lady, or she had located me. Who knows how that works? Ms. O'Keefe, my wife, my current wife, I always call her my current wife. I find it keeps her on her toes. Ms. O'Keefe is from a totally different background than mine. She was raised in a very nice home with devoted parents and servants and a fence and a dog. In a word, her family had a buck. And I drank a lot in those days, but I knew what was going on. I will not burden you with the details of my wedding day, but I assure you that when the O'Keefes from the South Bronx hit the Westchester Country Club, they set a few records. There was only one fight. It was not a very good fight. My Uncle Bernie hit a waiter. After that, we settled down and set up a housekeeping, and Ms. O'Keefe then began to produce children in a rather boring and monotonous fashion, and with the regularity that is known only to the devout Roman Catholic. And after about the second of these events, I received a phone call to report to the dean of the law school I had attended, and I went to see the dean. And he appointed me to the faculty, and I became Professor O'Keefe. And I responded to that appointment with great alacrity. And there I was, the boy professor. And I knew that I drank a great deal, and I knew that I couldn't do both. So I resolved that I would control my drinking. I was then 27, I think, when I determined that I'd have to control my drinking. And I did for about 3 months, and I never was very successful at it, but the time went by, and as the time went by, it turned out that I was competent to do that job. I was able to teach, and once I found out I was able to teach, then there was no point in controlling the drinking. So I went back out to drink the way I wanted to, and I only knew the one way how to drink. My father died when I was 2, and my brother Billy was 4 years older than I. Billy was my hero. Billy was not at all like me. Billy was tall and handsome and athletic and a Marine and all of that. And he was my brother and he was my hero. And I tried to do everything just like Billy. And I drank like Billy. I drank until I fell down. Or the place went on fire. Or the cops arrived. Or something happened to interfere with the drinking. I would see people leaving. I wonder where they were going. Oh my God, it's here. And they're going over. And in this period of time, Ms. O'Keefe and I bought a house, and we had it up to about 6 kids by then, I think. And all of the trappings of the middle class had become mine. I had a home and cars and membership in the obscure club here or there and all these children. And I had gotten involved in politics in a way. And I even ran for office one time and lost. And I was practicing law and teaching and politicking. And had you asked me in those days how I was doing, I would have told you I was doing very well. As a matter of fact, I would have told you I was doing very well, whether you asked me or not. One of my favorite themes. The truth of the matter was, at this age of 34, I had turned into a daily drunk. And my day would have killed an ordinary man. I used to come to in the morning in that wet bed, because the problem with the kidneys had continued unabated all those years, and I would struggle out of that damp sack, and I would begin my morning aerobics. My aerobics were performed kneeling on the floor of a bathroom with my head in a bowl, and I would have all the water running, water in the shower, and water in the tub, and water in the sink, because I did not want Mrs. O'Keefe and all those little O'Keefes to know that Professor O'Keefe was dying. I would struggle downstairs in my sincere blue suit, carrying over my shoulder, much like Santa Claus, a sack of wet laundry, because Mrs. O'Keefe told me that the diaper service was for the children. And she did not think that a lady of her extreme breeding ought to do the wash of a 34-year-old bedwetter. If you can imagine a man of my stature in the community starting off each morning with a load of wash. But once I got my wash out of the way, help was at hand. I used to keep a quart of vodka in the refrigerator. My children call that daddy's juice. And I would take a few bangs on daddy's juice. And then the question was, what would I throw up in front of all these people? I knew if I lit up a cigarette, it was all over. I would take a train into New York, and sooner or later I'd arrive at Grand Central. And for those of you who do not understand New York City, Grand Central is not really a railroad terminal. It is, as my friend Peter knows, a collection of saloons that are connected by tunnels. And I would tear around the tunnels and pop up here or there like a mole and do a repair job. Then I'd head for that imposing institution at the law school, and as soon as I got there, my first thought was, how do I get out of here? And I'd get out, and I'd tear across town and steal every morning. I would steal money from a law firm's petty cash, and then I'd be in business, and I'd go down to a bar by the courthouse where I really belonged. And then I'd buy a drink, and they'd buy a drink, and the bartender would buy a drink, and we'd all buy a drink. It was marvelous, and I had it figured out in some wonderful alcoholic way that I was particularly brilliant at 2 o'clock. So I'd schedule all my classes for 2 o'clock, and I'd tear up there and shortchange those poor law students who had come to sit at my feet. And then I'd get out of there as soon as possible and tear over to Grand Central to commute. Now, even though I grew up in the city, I understood the theory of commuting. Commuters are entitled to a drink before they get on the train. So I'd have 10 or 12. And I'd get on a train going north. It didn't have to go to Larchmont where I lived. North was good enough for me. And I usually arrive home about 7:30 or so and bounce off a few walls and take what was left of Daddy's juice out of the refrigerator and fill up an old cheese glass that some kid had left laying around and inquire if anybody wanted a martini. But I was the only one that drank in that house in those days. And I'd have a few pops, and then I would eat or not eat, depending on my mood. Evenings I would spend in civic endeavor. Lawyers are very fond of civic endeavor. Civic endeavor by me was cracking up the car or puking on some hostess's sofa or playing a little grab-ass with the ladies of Larchmont and a sorrier-looking crop you have never seen. Most nights I would just stay home and vegetate, and I would watch television with one eye like this, watch the television, try to get those sets to come together. And I'd be watching the television with one eye and drinking, and I would go through all the programming and through the news and on into the morning, drinking and watching with one eye. And finally, my big moment would come when they played the national anthem. And they would play that song, and the Marines would go up Mount Suribachi, and the destroyers would be coming through the water, and that song would be playing, and I would cry. Oh, what a country. I would cry and sob and weep. Then I go upstairs and wet the bed, and that's it. I was a great leaker. I leaked from all ends. Well, as anybody who ever been married can tell you, while all of this was going on, Mrs. O'Keefe was not entirely silent. From time to time, she would have the temerity to suggest that there was something radically wrong with the way that I drank. But I'd pay no attention to her. Why should I? First of all, she is my wife. How much can she know? Secondly, she is not an attorney, and I would remember that and tell her that. And then I would explain to her, because she's fairly dim, I would explain to her the relativity of drinking, which is to say that some people drink more than other people. And on a relative scale, I would tell her, I'm not such a big drinker. As a matter of fact, I don't drink as much as my mother. And she would say, nobody drinks as much. Oh. And then she had offended mother. I'd have to leave for a few days. I'd go over and see mom, you know. Can I get some? Well, all of this drove her nuts, and she betook herself to her physician, who, as you might imagine, is an obstetrician. And he could not discover anything the matter with her until she told him that she lived with a drunk. And this explained things to him, and he sent her home to me with a message. And the message she brought me was that her doctor, the obstetrician, had diagnosed her husband, the law professor, as an alcoholic. Oh, I was very upset to get this message. And I rose to defend myself, as was my custom. And I launched into one of my jury addresses, and the first point I made was still a good point, I think, was that I took a very dim view of a physician who would diagnose a patient without having seen the patient. I was against that shabby type of medical practice all too common in our country today. I then went into high gear, and I asked Mrs. O'Keefe a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. Yeah. How about that? Right. At this point, the conversation was coming downhill at a terrible rate, and then it happened. I don't know how this happened. It happened. I cannot explain to you how it happened. I can explain many, many other things to you, and I probably will in the second or third hour of this terrific talk I'm giving here. But in the middle of all of this yelling, I suddenly stopped, and I admitted to Mrs. O'Keefe, for the first time I ever admitted to anyone, there was at least the possibility that I drank too much sometimes. This was a very serious tactical error. 3 days later, I was in a mental institution in Stamford, Connecticut. And I was only there a matter of moments when I noticed a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. They had sandbagged the old professor, and I was overcome with great feelings of outrage and self-pity, because in addition to everything else bad that was going on, it happened also to be the occasion of my 35th birthday. And I mentioned this to a man in a white coat who was passing through, and I very carefully explained to that cretin that on that very day, I had attained age 35, and therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, I was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said there were two other presidents in residence, Washington and Jefferson, I think. And then he went away and he left me. And I did all of those warm, wonderful, happy, and interesting things that alcoholics do when they withdraw from alcohol. I shook, I sweat, I did everything else pleasant that you can think about. And I finally came up for air. And I was visited by three different psychiatrists. And I gave them three different stories. And I was brought into a room, and they told me I was in grave danger of being expelled from our mental institution. They said I was not cooperating. And I was cooperating. I was playing Monopoly with three guys. Around the clock, we had this Monopoly game going. And one of them... I was playing with these three fellows who were there. They weren't alcoholics. They were just there. And one of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. And if you know anything about the game of Monopoly and some nut thinks you're his real estate broker, you can do very, very well. I had the boardwalk. I had a number of hotels. I was very happy with the Monopoly. I was into the Monopoly marathon about the second day, and they said I had a visitor, and I didn't know what that would be, so I went into my large executive-type padded cell, and I waited for the visitor, and through that door came this very imposing man, and he announced that he was from the Darien, Connecticut group of Alcoholics Anonymous, that the hospital had given up on me and had asked him to speak to me of our program. And I immediately reverted to my origins because I was up and at him, and I almost had him by the throat. I said, "Alcoholic, what are you, out of your mind?" And I started with him. And he told me to shut up. Really. I immediately forgave him. Because I knew that they had neglected to tell him who I was. So I began to tell him who I was. He told me to sit down and to shut up and to listen to him. Well, he was an imposing-looking man, and I was not a well person. And so for the first time in 35 years, I sat, and he began to explain to me, as we are instructed in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, what his life had been like, how he had come to this program, and what life had been for him since. And he asked me if I would like to go with him to meetings. And I said, "Do you mean outside to meetings, sir?" He said, "Outside." I said, "I'll go." Besides that, he gave me matches. No one else allowed me to have any matches. And so that's how it began with me. That was in January of 1963. And we went all around, and he made arrangements for me to come home and told me where to go. And I came home, began to go to meetings locally. And I don't remember so much of all of that. I was too new and too nervous and too afraid and too everything. And the hospital had turned me loose with a large jar of those pills that they used to insist on giving alcoholics, and I was eating those things, and my head buzzed a lot. But I understood myself fairly well. I figured I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You would recognize me as a superior person. You would elect me your president. I was president of everything I ever joined. I was president of every class and organization there was. And I would serve a term as your president, and then that would be the end of that. It didn't work out. should come as no surprise to you, although it was a terrible blow to me, to find that I only lasted 10 months and then I was drunk again. And I was drunk with a great difference, because I had turned away from the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was to stay drunk for a period of time. And I won't bring you through that because it takes too long and it still makes me extremely nervous when I think about it. But let me just indicate to you that it was, without question, the worst period of my life. It was murder. It was pure and simple murder. I would drink a week and then I wouldn't drink a month. I'd drink a month and then I wouldn't drink a week. I would drink and come to these meetings. I would come to these meetings and then I would drink. I never knew when I'd be drinking, and I certainly never knew where I would be when I finished drinking. And things had begun to happen to me that had never happened to me before. And I do not speak to you now of things that happened to me in this period of time, which I no longer consider to be important. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was fired as a tenured professor of law and dismissed from the faculty, and that all of the honors and all of the appointments and all of the commissions and all of the dollars that went with that position were taken from me in about 15 minutes. I do not speak to you the fact that I was in serious, and I mean very serious, personal, professional, and financial difficulties. I do not even speak to you of the fact that I had lost the affection of all those who were around me. All of this happened to me in this period of time, but that's not what I'm talking to you about. What I now understand had happened to me in that period of time is that there was, in my case, and perhaps in yours, a terrible, terrible disintegration of my spirit. My spirit, that thing that separates me from my cat and separates me even from each of you. That spirit which gives to this particular form whatever individuality or personality or character that it might have. And this was the spirit which once burned in me so bright. And it was extinguished, and I knew it. And there was nothing I could do about it. I had been here, and this did not work for me. And by this time, I'd been everywhere else. I'd been through the hospitals and the doctors and the nurses, and I've been through the jobs and the politics and the money, and I've been up and down every avenue there was for people like me, and the result was always the same. I was drunk. And it wasn't as though I didn't know about drinking. I knew about drinking. I had a memory. I remembered the neighborhood. I knew about my family. I had been to the funerals. I knew what happened to people who drank the way I did. And even though I had all of this knowledge, as the book tells us, self-knowledge availed me nothing. And so I drank, and I continued to drink. And truly, truly, as I stand before you, I did not think that I would ever stop drinking. But my time came one day. One day, my time came. And I don't know any more about this than you do. But it seems to me that there is a time for all of us. And it seems to me that there is a time for each of us. I say to you that there is a line somewhere beyond which we are simply not permitted to go. And I say to you that there is a point somewhere below which we are simply not permitted to sink. And it seems to me that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. I don't know where this line is for you. I only know what happened to me. And this is a personal and an individual thing. And I think it is different in each case. And for some, it may be death. And that's the way it was for my brother Billy. They call one night from the Veterans Hospital in Minneapolis, and the man told me that my brother was dead of alcoholism, and that he had died in the Veterans Hospital where they had taken him when he had collapsed on the skid row of Minneapolis. And so my brother and my hero died the way alcoholics oft times do, without friends, without family. And he was a long, long way from our neighborhood. But my brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. And that's what happened to him. And for other people, it can be something very trivial. But the line is there, somewhere. And we all come to it in our own time and in our own way. But we come to it. We must. And I arrived on a day wasn't much different from so many other days. I was 2 or 3 days away from a drink. I was in this place where I had gotten a job. I was nervous. I was thirsty. I was going to go down in the lobby of the building. There was a bar. But I was given the great grace to call a longtime friend of mine and a longtime member of this program. And his name is John, and he is my sponsor. And I told him what was going on with me, and he said he'd be over. And he came over, and he walked into that room, and he looked so good, and I felt so bad. And I asked him how I could be as successful as he had been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he gave me that look that he has. And he said, "Don't drink. Go to meetings. You'll be all right." Well, I didn't want him to tell me that. And I told him I didn't want him to tell me that. I said, "John, you don't seem to understand the real problem. The real problem is this place where I work. A lawyer of my talent should not be in a place like this." Yeah, he said, "Well, you don't drink. You go to meetings. I might get a little better." I said, "At home, it's worse. I can't even go up there anymore. They don't allow me to go in there." "Well," he said, "don't drink, and you go to meetings, work out." I said, "I'm getting sued by Bankers Trust." He said, "Well, yeah, well, if you don't drink, you go to meetings, something would happen." I sensed that there was no dialogue there. I've never been as able to be as good a sponsor as my sponsor was to me. He was something. I would say to him, "I don't feel good." He'd say, "Well, this may be as good as you'll ever feel." I said, "Well, when am I going to get a good job?" He said, "You had one." Amazing. I say, "I'm very, very nervous." He'd say, "Hang on." I say, "How do you hang on?" He'd say, "Let go." And that day he knew I wasn't doing much. He said, "Come on." And he took me over and he stuck me on a train to Larchmont. He made some phone calls. And it's about a 40-minute ride up, you know. And halfway up, I reconsidered. You understand? What the hell did I call him for? I panicked. I must have panicked. "Don't drink, right? Don't drink my ass. Wait till this train stops." And that was my attitude when I got off the train. Standing on the platform of that train station was my mailman, a guy named Al. And Al said, "Get in the car." And I said, "Get out of here, Al. I don't hang around with mailmen." He said, "Some guy called me about you. Get in the car." So a man of my stature cannot afford to have a fist fight with a mailman or anybody else for that matter. I get killed. I got in Al's car. I said, "Al, I'm big problems here, Al." He said, "Yeah, well, don't drink. You got a meeting. You'll be all right." So if any of you are interested in my advice, because I'm from out of town, you want some advice? Don't drink, and you go to meetings. You'll be just fine. Don't worry about it. Everything's okay. Al took me up to the meeting that night with that group, and I didn't drink that day. And I haven't had a drink since. And that was November the 24th, 1965. And first I had that day. And I had that day because two members of this fellowship were so filled with the gratitude of this fellowship that they took what God sent that day, a drunken, dishonest, arrogant man. And because they were so very grateful for what they had received, they gave me a day. And because of that one day, I am convinced all of the other days have seemed to follow. And they had me going. I got my instructions. I was told to go to meetings every night. And I would go to meetings every night, and I still go to meetings every night. I go to 9 meetings a week. That seems to be enough for me. And I would see John every day, and I would see Al every night, and I'd get my instructions. And I was hanging around pretty good, and I had 3 or 4 months or so, and one day John said to me, because he was one of those kinder days, he said, "Trouble with you is you're ignorant." By this time I was used to him, and I said, "Please, sir, please tell me in what respect I am ignorant so that I may better serve you." He said, "You think Alcoholics Anonymous is to stop you from drinking?" I said, "Yes, I was under that impression, yes." "The name of the organization will give you a clue," I said, "yeah." He said, "AA is not for drinking." He said, "Drinking is not your problem." He said, "Something else is the matter with you." I said, "Well, tell me what it is." He said, "I can't do that, but I will give you this book. You will read it." So he gave me the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said, "Read this book." And then I had him. See? I said, "I read this book already. Rarely have we seen anyone fail who has thoroughly followed." And he gave me that look, you know, that horrible, horrible look that long-term members of AA reserve for smart-ass people. And he said, "Read it again." And I said, "Yes, John." Because by that time I had learned that no discussion with that man was ever over until I said, "Yes, John." And I began to read again the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was right. I had misunderstood the point. I had no idea that book had been written some 5 years after Bill and Bob had met, some 5 years after the program had begun, during which time 100 or so men and women had recovered from a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body. No idea at all. I didn't know that the steps that are contained in the 5th chapter of that book are steps actually and literally taken by these men and women as they became sober. I thought when first I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if I told you my name was Ray O'Keefe and I was an alcoholic, I was doing something about the first step. "Oh, that's my name, and I'm an alcoholic, all right." But the men and women who founded this program did a great deal more than simply identify themselves as alcoholics. They admitted that they were powerless over alcohol, that their lives had become unmanageable, and their lives had become unmanageable because they were powerless over alcohol. It was all the same thing with them. They were powerless. They had no power. They were without power. The book tells us that the dilemma of the alcoholic is his lack of power. He has no power. He is powerless. But they didn't drink. And time began to pass for them. As time has passed for the great conference at Hilton Head Island. And if you are new here, my brothers, and I know some of you are, time will pass for you. And time has passed for me. And time has a wonderful way of passing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It passes one day at a time. And somewhere after this succession of days, these men and these women came to believe that there was a power greater than their own. And they believed that this power could restore them to sanity. And this was not just a casual observation that they made or an offhand reference that they shared. They believed this. This was part of them. They believed that there was a power greater than their own. And as they believe, I believe. And so real and so true was that belief that they were able to make a decision. And the decision they made was a decision to turn over their will and their lives to the care of this great power that they had come to believe in, this God as they each understood him. And they were very, very bright, because at a time in the history of this country when no one else considered alcoholism a disease, they said that it was a disease that was physical and mental and spiritual, a disease of the body and of the mind and of the spirit. And when they stopped drinking, their bodies responded quickly. And when they came to believe, they enjoyed a mental recovery. It was a little slower than the physical recovery, but it was perceptible. They could notice it. And when they made that decision, that was the key that opened the door. And it laid down not only the basis for a spiritual recovery, but the basis for a spiritual way of life. And they were smart enough to know that it isn't enough to stop drinking and start praying. A lot of people have tried that. It doesn't work. They knew that if they were to be successful, somehow they would have to change. And in order to effect this change in themselves, they began a searching and a fearless moral inventory of themselves. They could be searching because by now they were relatively clear. They could become fearless because they made a decision to put their life into the care of the God of their understanding. Imagine an alcoholic without fear. That's impossible. It embarrasses me to tell you that the ruling emotion of my life when I drank was fear. For all of those years, the great man and the boy professor was afraid most of the time. This program takes care of that. And when they were finished with that inventory, and they had admitted it to themselves and to the God of their understanding, so great was the love and the affection of these people one for the other, even as I observe the love and affection of you people one for the other, that they were able to take this inventory and share it with someone else. It was a great relief for me to show this to my sponsor and have him explain to me the exact nature of my wrongs. I really wasn't clear on that until he did it for me. And then they developed an attitude which came hard for me. They became entirely ready to have God remove all their defects of character. And with compelling logic, they went to this great power that they had come to believe in. And they asked him, please, humbly, to take away their defects of character. And they asked their Creator to take from them everything which stood in the way of being useful to him and to the people around them. They asked their Creator to take everything, the good and the bad. And things began to happen for people. And things have happened for me. And for all of the millions of people who have come to this program since 1935. And the one thing upon which there must be unanimous opinion is that this program works. It really does. And if anyone had ever any doubt about it all they would have to do would be to come here to this conference tonight at this minute and just look in through the door. And there is proof beyond abundance that this program really works. Now they knew, these people who are our founders, they knew that they had not come here alone. They knew that in every life there was a certain amount of wreckage. And so they wrote a list of everybody they had ever harmed. And they became willing to make amends to everyone on the list. And you may recall that our book tells us that Dr. Bob spent his first day in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you recall, he came home late that night, and Bill asked him where he'd been, and he said he was out mending fences. It was his first day when he began to stop drinking, and he was making amends. And I don't think we should wait very long in our programs to do all of the things that are expected of us, especially when the rewards are so great. You will recall with me what they tell us happens to us when we have completed our ninth step. It says that if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past or wish to shut the door upon it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience will benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us all of the things that we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are happening to us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. And I'm here to report to you that each and every one of those promises has come into my life, wholly and solely and simply because I'm a member of this program. And by this time, these men and women were fairly sober people. And the book says that they had ceased fighting anyone or anything. And there had been a restoration to sanity. And they realized that what had been given to them was something very, very precious. And so they resolved to maintain it. And in order to maintain it, they continued to take personal inventory. When they were wrong, they promptly admitted they were wrong. They knew they could not be resentful or hateful. They knew if they were hateful, they would drink. And if they drank, they would surely die. And then, so great, so true, and so real, was their reliance upon a power greater than their own. But they sought to improve their conscious contact with God. And they did that by prayer and by meditation. They meditated. They gave thought to their condition. They considered who they were and what they were. And they engaged in a very excellent form of meditation. It is the form of meditation in which you are now engaged. They listened. They listened on the odd chance that this power that they had come to believe in would speak to them. And this power that they had come to believe in did speak to them
in their groups, at their meetings. And they prayed, brothers. They prayed. No one needs a sermon from me on the value of prayer. When they prayed only for knowledge of God's will for them and the power to carry that out. I can never tell how it's been for you, but it always seemed to me from a very, very young age I had this terrible, terrible feeling that I did not belong. I knew without anybody telling me that I did not belong in that family. I knew that was a big mistake. I did not belong in that neighborhood. I did not belong in those schools. And I just did not belong. And the problem I had was that this feeling was very, very strong, and it persisted in me even though I was going through the system successfully. I was a successful kid. I had a lot of friends. I was very, very good at school. I was good at everything I did. I lived in the right place. I worked at the right job. I lived in the right town. Everything was fine, except I did not belong. And when you have that feeling, and if you've had it, it centers here somewhere, and the wind blows, and it makes the days very long, and it makes the nights very dark. And then I came to you, and I learned to pray. And in the 12 and 12, they tell us in the last paragraph of the chapter on prayer that perhaps one of the greatest benefits of prayer is the sense of belonging that comes to us. We are no longer lost or alone or frightened or purposeless. That despite all of the evidence in the world around us in purely material affairs, we understand that a loving God watches over us. And we know that when we draw near to Him, all will be well with us here and hereafter. And I can report to you that that sense of belonging has come to me. It is not so much that you do me the great honor of allowing me to speak at your conference. I belong here. I am supposed to be here. This is where I belong. And this is the program that saved my life. And I'm not a stranger here. I belong here. And that feeling now, I best tell you, when I tell you my name is Ray O'Keefe and I am an alcoholic and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, what I'm really telling you is who I am and what I am and where I belong. And that makes me feel good. A little later, they came upon a prayer they thought might help. And you and I have already prayed that prayer tonight together. And they prayed for themselves, but all they asked was peace of mind. So they asked God to grant them the serenity to accept the things they could not change. And they did change. Something happened to these men and women. Something has happened to me. Something happens to everyone who comes here. There was a great difference in their lives. There is a great difference between being drunk and being sober. There was a great conversion of their values and a great substitution of their standards. And this difference, the difference between being drunk and being sober, they termed a spiritual awakening. And they had this spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And these were the men and the women who at the beginning of this process had admitted that they were helpless and hopeless and powerless. These were the ones that had no power, but having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, they found that they held in their hands and in their hearts and in our program one of the greatest sources of spiritual power that the world has ever seen. They actually had the power to arrest the disease of alcoholism. They actually had the power to save life. And the only thing they were using was the great power of example of one drunk for another. And armed with that power, and having had that kind of a spiritual awakening, they tried to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffered. And they did that so well that you and I have come together on a night in January in 1988 in the most beautiful island of Hilton Head in the state of South Carolina. And that, my dear, dear brothers, is a long, long way from Akron, Ohio. And they knew. They knew what my sponsor knew. They knew what my friends here know. That there is so much more to this program, so much more than simply a device to keep us from drinking. They knew what had handed to them was an entirely new way of living. And in order to enjoy that new way of living, they resolved that they would practice principle in all their affairs. And so where they had been, as I always was, very dishonest, they tried to be honest. Where they had been, as I always was, very arrogant, they tried not to be so arrogant. Happily for me and for us all, they said we were not saints. They said this is not a program of spiritual perfection. It is a program of spiritual progress. And my sponsor has instructed me, and so I believe, that I can progress in the program if I don't drink and I go to the meetings. I could keep you forever and tell you of all of the good things that have happened to me since I have become sober. But I would not keep you that long. I want to get at that ice cream. Just let me tell you that everything, every single thing that alcoholism took from me, every position, every honor, every title, and every dollar, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has returned to me in a way which I do not understand and I'm not worried about. Every single position, honor, title, and dollar has come back and put it right in place. It's an amazing, amazing program. And to show you where the O'Keefes are at this point, I bring you the warm and the fraternal greetings of seven of my children who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. The last one came in a month ago. We're keeping an eye on him. So, that's where the O'Keefes are. I, of course, would be remiss if I didn't thank Marie and this committee, or whoever it was who exercised the extreme good judgment to bring me here for the period of time I have been on this island when I met Pete and Meredith. From the very minute I arrived in this island up till this very minute, I have felt at home. I have felt a part of this conference. And for that, I thank you all. I am one of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, like Martha and Sue and Rod, who travel around from place to place with my sad little story behind me. Everywhere I go, I say the same thing. And if you've heard this before, or on tape, you're hearing it again. And I make no apology for that. And every time I end, I say the same thing. And that's how I do it. I remember a pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is very dear to me, and it's called A Member's View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that pamphlet, the author takes a biblical turn at the very end. And he reminds us of the time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin Jesus as to whether or not he was the Messiah. And so these two men found the Lord, and they walked with him a while. And one day they stopped him, and they said to him, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one that we have been waiting for? Or should we wait for another?" And the Lord really did not answer that question. But he said to these two men, "Go back to John and tell him only what you have seen and only what you have heard. Tell John that the blind see and the lame walk. And tell John that the deaf can hear and the sick are made well. And tell John that the poor have the gospel brought to them." In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And everyone knows that the word gospel is simply means good news. And so, my dear, dear brothers, here at Hilton Head Island in Happy Conference Assembled, if you will accept a report from me based upon my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will tell you only what I have seen and only what I have heard. And based upon that observation, it seems to me that the blind do see and the lame do walk. And I know that the deaf can hear. And most certainly, the sick are made well. And I have seen over and over and over again, through the longest day and into the darkest night, the good news of this program brought to the alcoholic who suffers, the poor in spirit. Thank you.
Thank you.